Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. Rules for Old Men Waiting is the first novel from author Peter Pouncey. It tells the story of one man at the end of his life with only his memories, a cold, crumbling house, and his failing health to keep him company. Robert McKeevy, a tough Scotsman, rugby-playing war veteran, and military historian, could easily just give up and slip away into darkness. But he resolves to not go gentle into that good night, and the resolution begins with a list of daily rules by which to live. Keep clean, eat regularly, play music, read, and write a story. The story he writes is one of honor, betrayal, and revenge on a World War I battlefield. It's a war story that prompts his own memories of his father's death in that war, his own experience in World War II, and his son's tour of duty in Vietnam. And as he follows his daily rules of eating, writing, remembering, and imagining, he learns something essential about himself, about his beloved former wife, about his own life at the very end. Connection listeners, how can we best confront and embrace the aging process? How does one find meaning in the later stages of life? And what role does the mind play as the body begins to fail? The number is 1-800-423-8244. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And my guest now is Peter Pouncey, author of the new novel, Rules for Old Men Waiting. He's the former dean of Columbia College and president emeritus of Amherst College, and he joins us from a studio in New York City. Peter Pouncey, thank you for being with us, and welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Anthony.
It's a real pleasure to have you. I read your book, enjoyed it very much, and there's a lot to talk about in here. And I wanted to start this way. I said a little bit in the intro about the book's hero to set up what your book is about, but fill it out for us a little bit. Tell us a little more about your protagonist, Robert McKeevy.
Yes, he's a tough old Scottish bird. He's been a professor. He's in many ways intemperate. But when we meet him first, he's coming to bits. His wife is dying and dies in the first few pages. His house is coming apart, and he hasn't been looking after himself or his house. And he seems to be having delusions, maybe from malnutrition.
Mm.
And there's a point where he seems to make a sort of half-hearted effort to commit suicide. He goes out into the snow, which is deep, and he's orthopedically very frail. And the likelihood is he will crunch through the icy snow and never make it back inside again. And he thinks about that, and he sees a headline in a paper coming from the spring, which reads, "Historian's Body Found by Summer People." And he looks at the headline, and he decides he doesn't like it. And at that point, he decides to sort of take hold of himself, and that's what the book is about.
Mm. Now, there are a lot of themes running through this book, and I want to talk to you about all of them in this hour. This is a war story. It's also about how we use memory and imagination. And of course, as you suggest, it's about a man confronting the end of life. That seems to be the most powerful theme in the book. What drew you to that?
Well, I suppose I'm always asked how autobiographical is this, and I'm 67. Let's get it down on paper, turning 68 all too soon.
Mm.
And I'm an academic, and I tell everyone there are two phases in an academic's life. The first phase is the time clock that runs towards tenure. And there you know what the final term is to a second. It has to be, let's say, June the 30th, 2005, after 7 years. And if you're lucky, you sort of crawl out of the rapids onto the shelf of tenure, and you lie there wheezing for a number of years, and then you recover. The second time frame is towards the end of your life, and it's the time frame you have when you have full possession of your faculties, and there is no term date.
Mm.
You don't know when your marbles are going to be taken from you. Mm. So there is a kind of urgency, and people say, is this book depressing? I would say it's not depressing because McKeever gets the ending I think we would all wish, I certainly wish, that he retains the full use of his faculties, of his thinking powers, of his memory, of his imagination, literally to the last second of his life. And that's the way we all want to go.
Connection listeners, Connection listeners, we want to invite you to join this conversation. How can we best confront and embrace the aging process? How does one find meaning in these later stages of life? You can join the conversation by calling 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Join the conversation with Peter Pouncey about his new book, Rules for Old Men Waiting. Peter Pouncey, let's talk about how your protagonist, Robert McKeevy, confronts this period. And maybe a good way to do that would be to, if I could get you to do a brief reading.
Sure.
There's a reading that begins on page 17 about this list that he puts together after, as you described, he realizes he doesn't want to be a headline about a frozen corpse found by summer people.
Right. Well, I'll read you the list of rules as he first elaborates them, and then he does some corrections of them. Over the next 2 days, pottering around the house, he evolved his rules for winter watch, rules for the inside game. What they really were was a plan to take back his life until he could give it away on an acceptable basis. Meanwhile, it would be healthy for him to tell himself what to do. 1. Keep personally clean. 2. Make bed every morning and clean house twice a week. 3. Dress warmly and light fire when necessary, burning least important things first. 4. Eat regularly. 5. Play music and read. 6. Television only in the evening, except for weekend and seasonal showdown sports. 7. Work every morning, nap in afternoon if needed. He wrote these down and read them over. They offered, he thought, a simple skeleton of the well-ordered life for a feeble old man. He found nothing to take exception to. But over the next 2 days, as he continued to wander, still a little uncertainly, through the house, he came to realize that some of the rules needed further clarification if he was to act on them. Rules 3, 4, and 7, in particular, needed glossing, regulations for the application of the law. He took a fresh piece of paper, headed it, Rules for Winter Watch, Reform State, and added further subsets under the headings, Correct Order for Burning Household Objects, Calculations for Rationing Food per Diem, and Appropriate Work for Winter Watch.
Now, eventually, Peter, he ends up expanding this list further to include writing every day. I mean, that becomes the working every morning.
Exactly.
Yeah. And why is that so important to him? Or why should it be important to anybody, I suppose?
Yeah, it's important to him. This is not a man, we feel, who is deep on introspection. And the telling of the story really gets him involved in thinking up 4 characters for himself and bringing them into action, actually in a trench in World War I, because his professional work has been as a military historian expertise in World War I. But he makes up 4 characters who are basically, I think, fractions of himself, all 4 of them. And his insistence is that he should drive the story to the end. He says, not just the shards, the whole damn pot. And so when you start telling yourself a story close to the end of things, it could be like a bedtime story. But the need before you go to sleep, but it could be more than that. His insistence that it has to be finished is that it's a kind of last will and testament that he's sort of telling himself, and he wants it finished. And I see it as sort of taking stock of his whole life through the work of his imagination.
And that's what happens. I mean, I want to talk in the next segment when we have a little more time. I want to talk about the story that he writes. But I was struck later in the book, McKeever is recalling a scene from his childhood, and you write, McKeever realized he seemed to be making some kind of tally of his memories, as though completing the inventory might tell him what his life amounted to. I found that really, really poignant. It reminds me of someone in my own family who struggled to keep writing toward the end of his life. And he said to me, you know, if I don't keep writing and recalling, it's like I never lived at all because I'm forgetting so much.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, Anthony. The point is, you know, we do remember things, but we rarely put our memories together in sort of sequences and count what they add up to. And that seems to be some of what he's doing here.
Mm-hmm. Connection listeners, join the conversation with Peter Pouncey, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. His new book is Rules for Old Men Waiting. And Peter Pouncey joins us from New York. We're going to be back in a moment. We're going to take a short break and take your calls. Once again, that number is 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. The question we're asking is, how does one find meaning in the later stages of life? And what lessons do they offer for maybe the mid stages of life? Join the conversation. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be back in a moment. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks. I'm talking to author Peter Pouncey, who's just written Rules of Old Men Waiting, a wonderful novel about memory, about loss, about the end of life, and about war. And we're asking you, Connection listeners, how does one find meaning in the later stages of life, and what role does the mind play as the body begins to fail? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-8244. That's 1-800-423, and I said that number incorrectly, which is sort of hard to imagine. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK makes the Peter Pouncey connection. One more question to you, Peter Pouncey, then I want to go to our callers who are pushing to get in on this conversation. We mentioned that one of the big themes running through this is war, and your protagonist, Robert McKeever, decides to write a war story. Tell us a little bit about the story that he decides to write.
Well, as I said, he has been an expert in World War One. He decides he will do a fictional rendering of a very small group of men, a platoon, who are stuck in the trenches in World War One. They are English. They come from the Norfolk Regiment. And he basically concentrates on four of them, he invents. And really, the main business of war seems to be almost subordinate on the sidelines from their own interactions with each other. It's a story of sort of cruelty and inhumanity, and it's finally put right by a wonderful old private soldier who sort of lives through it, is wise, it seems, and so it finally brings it to an end. But the interesting thing, perhaps, is that it concentrates on the violence inside human nature more than it does on the violence coming at them from across no man's land.
Interesting. And, of course, it's something that Robert McKeever, your hero, picks up on and sort of recognizes the rage that he lives with for so much of his life. And that seems to come out as he writes this story.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Let's take a call. James is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, James.
Hi. My question has a kind of archaeology of its own. I remember with great delight being a freshman at Columbia College in the early 70s when Peter was dean and one of the most scholarly and witty and best-loved deans in memory there. And at the time, Professor Pouncey was writing about Thucydides, and Partly inspired by him, I've taught Thucydides myself to freshmen for years now. I'm now at Harvard. And I was wondering whether Thucydides' own approach, his analysis of war, of the way it changes human psychology, his discussions of the way people are bent out of shape by power, by the exigencies of life, was one of the inspirations to write a novel which takes some of these themes, I think, in a very personal way, in the way that the novel has evolved such analyses over the last 2.5 millennia.
James, thanks for that. Peter, influenced by the study of Thucydides?
Yes. Yeah, my main man. I think I identify the caller, and I'm not going to elaborate on that, but I do remember him back in that class because he stood out. I think he's an eminent professor at Harvard now. So we're leading off with great power here. But he's absolutely right that Thucydides is a huge force. I was 14 when I first had to read a chunk of Thucydides in Greek for an exam, and I've been with him ever since, and I did my doctoral dissertation on him, and then I wrote a book on another piece of him. And that's exactly right. It starts, really, for Thucydides, the question of how we get into these imbroglios of war with the violence that is at the heart of human nature. And I seem to believe that in the sort of fiber of my bones, and that's probably a heavy influence on this story.
Interesting. James, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
It's great that you've made this connection with your former with your former professor.
Yes.
And you want to follow up with him?
I guess just one more point, which is that Peter was then a very young dean and young scholar, and we all age in academia and go through the shoals of tenure, as he evoked them very memorably, kind of like salmon swimming upstream and so on. And I guess it seems to me very Athenian and noble in an archaic sort of way to write a book like this, which points the way for us academics as we get older, simply as human beings as well, to hold our heads high when we go into the dark. And I'd like to thank him for that. And I guess just to say that it's really an inexpressible joy to hear he's well and creating, which is, of course, the very opposite of war. And to thank The Connection for making us aware of this novel, which I will now go out and purchase.
Well, thanks for the call, James.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Peter, James raises a point about this theme of war and destruction and killing, and yet in this context you have used it to create such an affirmative message.
Yes, well, I liked everything James said, actually. I enjoyed it hugely, right to the last sentence of going out and buying the book, which is, that it's not quite as noble and Athenian and disinterested as he would like.
No, I think you're being a little hard on yourself here.
Yeah. But the big thing is that McKeever's embrace of the rest of his life, that he does not do the final act of violence on himself, seems to me a kind of hopeful message. He does not finish himself off. He rides it out and makes something of the remnant of his days. And that's impressive.
I was wondering if we could do another reading about which comes from the story that he's writing. And this is begins on page 30 about the platoon sergeant, Reggie Braddis, who seems, at least as I read the book, to embody a lot of this sort of bellicose rage that is central in this story.
Yes, he does. That
it's a frightening depiction of a soldier, but a poignant one too.
Right. Well, after he's actually finished what I'm going to read you a small piece of it. It says, McKeever was satisfied with Braddis. It was clear he would be nothing but trouble after he's drawn the portrait of him from which he will work. So I'll read you just the first exposure we have to this very professional, very tough soldier. Tuesday afternoon after tea, as always at this time, Reggie Braddis sat on the fire step cleaning his nails before a few interested and sycophantic observers. Actually, the ritual began with the filing and oiling of his bayonet, whose top 3 inches he kept razor sharp on both sides and about half the regulation width. Sometimes it was just a matter of a few loving strokes with the file and testing its edge by slicing the oily cloth with which he anointed it. But on other occasions, the week's work had broken the point, and he would have to start to replicate the edge lower down. Even when this had happened, Braddis would always wait until Tuesday before repairing his bayonet. He liked conveying the impression of military ritual and order. No one had ever witnessed the work which had damaged the bayonet, because it was always done in no man's land, in the middle of the night. Sergeant Braddis would earlier lead out the regular patrols and wire parties, but after he'd brought them back, he would go out again on his own. He seemed to need no sleep at all. There was enough excitement in the regular business of war, and in the license it gave him for irregular business of his own, to keep his adrenaline pumped at all times. On these occasions, solitary sallies, he would not take his rifle with him. Only the bayonet in its sheath and a couple of booby-trapped bombs he prepared from mortar shells on Friday afternoons at the same time. There were many unsavory legends, which he did nothing to discourage, about his solitary exploits in No Man's Land, or Braddis Land, as he liked to call it.
Braddis Land. It's a place I don't want to go. But he's something. Why is he important to McKeever? I mean, what does McKeever discover about himself at the end of his life writing about Braddis?
McKeever has been a great athlete in his day. He's the wreck of an athlete. He played rugby for Scotland. And he played, his father was killed in World War I in the Royal Flying Corps. And it says after his father's death, he played all the games, the ones between the chalk-marked lines on the playing fields and the ones played out in the wild with a fierce abandon which used to intimidate even his own teammates. Well, it is that sort of wild abandon that the soldier Braddis is a great professional. He's a great athlete. And McKeever studies him closely, sees that, in a sense, he still admires him. He loves the way he controls his environment in No Man's Land. He loves the way the men automatically follow his lead because he's the only one who will bring them home safe. Mm. And so it really, even though he has all these aberrations, which we didn't read you any of, but he really sort of jogs McKeever's memory about the own excesses of his growing up. Mm. There is a moment in the middle of an international where McKeever actually tramples the back of his own teammate's knee to remove him from the action because he seems to be blocking their progress. Mm. So he has this sort of unscrupulous streak himself.
Yeah, McKeever is a pretty effective warrior himself. And when he recalls, in fact, the battle that he engages in World War II, a naval battle, one of his fellow officers says to him, "You love what you do, don't you?" And then a bit later he says, "The thing about you is that you have a lot of violence in your nature and only a piece of you disapproves of the fact. You'd better find a gentle girl and marry her so you can learn the rest."
Yeah. Yeah, that's really the beginning of self-knowledge.
It's interesting. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about self-knowledge toward the end of life with Peter Pouncey and his book, Rules for Old Men Waiting. Let's take a call. Sarah is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. I want to thank you for a very interesting program, especially being an old lady who has recently encountered her 80s. And I want to, I just have to first say, because I've been listening, that I am a peacenik and have been a pacifist all my life. And so my interest in the remaining time I have is anti-war of all kinds. But I think it's all evil, 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 and that we are very wrong to be in a war at all. Now, but that's not my main point was that I think we should all remember as we age that poem by Milton, I think it's on his blindness.
Yes.
And I, too, I can't read Mr. McKeever's book. Is that his name?
Yes.
Peter Pouncey's book.
I can't read Peter Pouncey's book because I am legally blind, and so I can't read anymore. So, of course, I listen to WBUR all the time.
We're glad to hear that.
Anyway, when we think of Milton's blindness, he says at the end of his poem, "They also serve who only stand and wait." So let's be encouraged if we can't read like me, or if we can maybe, hopefully, do some work for peace, because I still have my body fairly strong, and I can take Tai Chi, and I keep my legs strong, and I want to go on a peace march. So please, WBUR, tell me about one that I can join. And let's remember Milton. They also serve who only stand and wait. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, for that call.
Okay, I'm through. Bye.
Bye-bye. Peter Pouncey, do you want to respond to that? Respond to that Milton line.
Yes, well, it is the great line. And McKeever is sort of waiting, but he is also trying to work his way to his end. And I suppose, I mean, Milton retained his dignity and power right to the end, and we all do it in our own way. I'm very much with most of Sarah's very sincere remarks. I can't join her all the way on pacifism. I do believe there are people who need to be stopped, of which in my lifetime the key one has been Hitler, and I'm not prepared to extend it a whole lot further than that. Mm. But the fact that our society still sees war in Clausewitz's famous phrase is war is the pursuit of political goals by other means, and that's such a sort of polite euphemism. I mean, what it is, by violent means.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we go to war, we don't actually go to talk to the enemy. We go to kill them. And when they come against us, they're not in the business of talking to us anymore. They're in the business of killing us. And that says an awful lot about human nature and human history. And we have not advanced, I would submit, one step from my man Thucydides in the 5th century B.C.
And you make that point in this book, in that there are really three generations of warfare that you reference. I mean, there's this story about World War I written by a man whose father died in that war. He served in World War II, and his son has a pivotal experience in the Vietnam War. So
yes.
Three generations of men in his family, three wars, all defining them in various ways.
Yeah, exactly. Someone actually at a reading elsewhere sort of taxed me and said, you and your man McKeever really do see the 20th century as framed by the big landmarks of the wars and their aftermath, don't you? And I had to say, yes, I do. And someone else said, well, there are rising trajectories in the 20th century. For example, life expectancy. Mm. I mean, the average American male died at 54 at the start of the 20th century, and we've gained 20 years on that.
We're going to continue the conversation with Peter Pouncey, author of Rules for Old Men Waiting. We invite your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking about themes of war, imagination, at the end of life. Give us a call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks, sitting in for Dick Gordon. I'm talking to Peter Pouncey, author of Rules for Old Men Waiting, a book about memory, imagination, a book about war, a book about thinking about a lot of things at the end of life. It's not just a book about what happens at the end of life, but that's a big theme that we're focusing on in this hour, and we're inviting you to call 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, and join the conversation about Rules for Old Men Waiting and author Peter Pouncey. Let's go to Leanne, who's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Leanne.
Hi. Mr. Pouncey, I just wanted to mostly thank you. I'm calling as someone who's kind of a grandchild of the generation that you're writing about, and this really has some personal significance for me. My grandmother just was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and for years now, she's been an amazing storyteller and really someone who kind of made the details of her life come alive for all of her family members, and we've urged her for years to actually document those memories. And for whatever reason, she really didn't think that it was important to do that. I don't know if she didn't think they were significant enough or why, but she's at a point now that she can no longer do that, and I think all of her family members are really, really disheartened, and we're trying to hold on as much as we can and document as much as we can of her memories. And I'm hoping that people can read your book and take from that that not only is the documentation healing and kind of reaffirming for the person who's nearing their death, but it also creates a more, robust context for the generations that follow them to have an understanding of where they came from.
Hmm. Peter Pouncey, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, what a lovely thing. To say, yes, I think you should write them down, Leanne. I think you should write them down, and you should remind her of them and sort of tell them back to her. And perhaps you could say, have I got that right? And my bet is that pieces of her memory will remain extremely sharply particular, and she'll make small corrections, but she will feel that pieces of her life are still available to her. I think it's wonderful what you're doing, but none of us can escape from the pain of watching this sort of process of disappearance in those we've loved. It's really a terrifying thing.
Leanne, thank you for your call. Peter Pouncey, you know, it occurred to me as I was reading this book and the title, the Rules for Old Men Waiting, did they suggest some universal principles as well that apply to all people? I mean, this idea of the sort of order and the discipline that he brings late in his life to hold on to it and to live it out fully to the end. They're pretty universal, aren't they?
Yes. Some of them I think maybe absolutely set for everybody. Some will be weaker, like our children, perhaps when they're small, on keeping personally clean or something like that. But maybe we put more weight on that. When McKeever gets into the small print of his stuff, he can be slightly sort of buccaneering. He hasn't kept up the wood pile, which is necessary for his wood-burning stove, and so he starts burning household objects. Mm. And he is perfectly resigned to burning books, too.
But only ones he doesn't like, right?
Yeah, he says books of rival scholars and other trash before good books and my own, he says. So we all have our quirky insistences. But the point is, I think when you have limited time and cannot attend to everything, I think we get inclined to narrow the focus of what we will attend to. And we probably all do sort of make rules for ourselves that this is what I'm going to do before I do anything else.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK joins the Peter Pouncey Connection in a discussion about Rules for Old Men Waiting. Let's go to Van, who's calling from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Van.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you for calling.
Very, very good show. I listen quite often. I'm just retired, 65 years old. At the time of retirement, there was a slight difficulty, not much. I'm an artist. so a visual artist, and I could always bring my work home. But you kept seeing people around you who simply were not making it. They couldn't do what they needed to do. What I wanted to do was to give you some of the things that I've done. It's you know, learning time. This is the best learning time because you have enough knowledge to talk to people, to understand and to teach. It's a beautiful time to be in. Children are a prize. Most people don't understand it. My father never really wanted to talk to children, but you can teach children by talking to them, and you can also learn from them because they have a very different kind of outlook on life, and it helps you in what you're able to do. Teens are a little bit more difficult, but still a beautiful experience. Older people.
Van, it sounds like what you're talking about is there's time to suddenly do this.
Thank you.
Yeah,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
Peter Pouncey, do you want to respond to Van?
Well, he's just a boy if he's 65. he's got infinite time coming to him. But I love your program. It sounds exactly right, Van. And you're right that children are essentially rejuvenating creatures. They keep us young, and we learn from them. And sometimes they even learn things themselves from us.
Van, thanks for the call. Peter, tell me why you waited a relatively long time to write this first novel. I mean, I guess I have two parts to this question. You know, why did you write it, and why did you wait so long to write it?
Well, it sort of falls in two stages. The first passage that is actually in the book that I can date was written in August of 1981, which is an awfully long time ago, 24 years ago. But I was not planning a novel at that point. I was doing other things. I was administering. I was trying to write history and so on. And I was teaching. And so really the writing of fiction was for me a kind of relaxation and possibly a reprieve from what one was doing with one's regular life. And it was only about more than 10 years later that I started to want to connect this and make a coherent novel out of it. And I think the push to me is that I think I've been always visually oriented myself. I see images. And I've always been challenged by the temptation to sort of put the right words on images, to describe them in words. And I think there are a lot of people with my particular temperament. When I taught Thucydides, whom James mentioned right at the start of the program appropriately, you know, that's a war set in the 5th century B.C., the students I was teaching were towards the end, not even born during the Vietnam War. And I would ask them what images they carry from the Vietnam War. Often 80% of a whole classroom of 30-odd people would put their hands up, and they would all remember the little girl running naked after being napalmed. With American soldiers on either side and the burning village behind her. And, you know, none of us can remember a New York Times editorial about the war at this point. But the picture, which has a moral force, that if being there means we're doing that sort of thing, then maybe we shouldn't be there. That the picture is literally undying, even from people who don't share the history of the event. And that has always had a big force, and that's been what drives me to try and make images cohere to a sort of set of conclusions.
Well, I must say, I mean, by way of giving you a compliment, I mean, the way you describe I mean, just for one example in the book, the engagements at the front lines during World War I are chilling. I mean, they are very vivid. You bring them to life in a really visual and powerful way. Let's take another call. Joanne is calling from Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. This is so exciting. I cannot tell you how amazed I am that you are here and talking about this at this moment. I have a father who is turning 85 this summer who seems to have discovered some of these same rules for living on his own in the process of his life and taking care of my mother, who has Alzheimer's. He has set aside, just in the last year, he's decided he needs to set aside time every morning while my mother is being cared for to do his reading, to do his writing. He's doing some writing of his own history. He's taken on additional projects to help the place where they live. He's agreed to be the chaplain of the health center where my mother lives. He was a chaplain in World War II. He comes from a family that has a tradition of writing the family history. And I am finding, as I'm 59, I am finding an increasing physical need to write down as much as I can of my family's history and my own. And I'm astonished at the Thucydides thing, because when I was a kid, my father, who had minored in history, had, actually I think he majored in history, had always tried to name our cats Thucydides. I thought he was just kidding and trying to tease us. Now I'm finding I'm going to have to go read about Thucydides.
Yeah.
Because there is this amazing connection, sorry to use your word, but that runs through his life and mine, and obviously I'm going to have to get this book for my father and for myself. This is quite remarkable, and I thank you so much for talking about this, for writing about this, for bringing this forward. I think the only thing I want to add is that my father seems to have discovered the need to remain physically active. He walks, he swims, he's recently gone horseback riding. He went with my son canoe riding over Memorial Day. He wants to be as physically active as he can, and his stated goal is to live at least, but only, a month longer than my mother to be sure that she is well cared for. But he has no particular interest in going beyond that. But I'm suspecting, from what I'm seeing in his actions, that he's finding a reason to live in what he's doing for other people and what he's writing for family and for others.
Joanne, thank you so much for the call. It sounds like your dad could be one of the characters out of Peter Pouncey's book, or another Peter Pouncey novel, I should say. Peter Pouncey, Joanne raises an interesting point, and well, a lot, and I'd like you to respond in any way, but the idea of her father wanting to live only a month longer than his wife, this has real parallels with your protagonist, Robert McKeever.
Yeah. Joanne's dad is clearly a great heroic figure, and it sort of looks as though I may have plagiarized McKeever from him. It's a very close parallels, and a man who knows Thucydides is heading in the right direction from the word go. McKeever is actually dying of a terminal disease, and he knows it, and his frailties are sort of incidents in the story as the book develops, and we won't tell you the ending of it. So he does not see himself. He actually says at some point, you know, never mind the mistakes. The only real mistake I've made is to live on after Margaret died. He really wants it to come to an end. he sets himself this chore to be completed, this sort of dedicated piece of work. But he really doesn't care when he goes. So that is very similar, that he knows mm-hmm. this particular relationship, the relationship with his wife Margaret, has kept him from his worst impulses, as it were, mm-hmm. in his life. And so the emptiness of his life at the end is sort of inviting death. And at first it seems that he's just going to allow himself to fall away
right.
and die. But I do admire that in him, that is not, almost in terms of good taste, that is not the way to go. You should hold on to yourself
right.
Until you give it.
We only have about a minute left, even less than a minute. So this is probably too big a question to bring up now, but I can't resist. You know, you write about a man who learns so much about himself and his life in the course of writing a novel, writing a story.
Right.
I'm wondering, you know, what happened to you in writing this story? I mean, what did you learn?
For me, the big thing was actually, and this is, McKeever and I are exactly the same, in the sense that we both want to finish what we started. And so for me, I don't see it as any sort of end, and now nunc dimittis, that I can go into the dark myself. To me, it was a relief and a release into being a writer. And you know, I've pushed words around all my life, but I have not written for myself in this particular way, and I want to keep doing that.
Well, Peter Pouncey, thank you so much for coming in and talking about your book. It was really a pleasure to read, and it was an enormous pleasure having you here.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
Peter Pouncey is author of Rules for Old Man Waiting. Rules for Old Man Waiting. You can get more information on our website at theconnection.org. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection.